Boeco Diamond Necklace and Scandinavia lit up the track at Goodwood last week, and amidst it all, another almighty governance row rocks British racing alongside a heavy hit to the sport's finances. Welcome to the front page. This was a week that reminded you what racing can be at its best. We had superstars performing on the track, young jockeys bursting into the limelight, and two festivals delighting fans on either side of the Irish Sea. But away from the track, there was a lot of news happening as well. We had over 130 betting shops closed with a major hit to British racing's finances. And then today, on Monday, the news that the Jockey Club was quitting the RCA, bringing the politics and governance of British racing back into the spotlight. We'll be discussing all of that on today's show, and who better to do it than Mr. Governance himself, Jonathan Harding, fresh from Goodwood. How was your week down there?
Brilliant. Yeah, like you say, it was fantastic racing, as you would expect. Boeco, chiefly, was an amazing moment. So good to focus on that while everything was being satellite elsewhere in the sport.
Often the way in British racing,
always
isn't
the
it?
Way.
Always the way. And in Lambourne, Mr. Lambourne himself, Liam Head. How are you, Liam?
Oh, good, Tom. Yeah, looking forward to an action-packed show, both in terms of on the track and off the track.
Certainly plenty to get into, so let's dive straight into it. John, we're going to begin with today's breaking news, which is that the Jockey Club have announced they're going to be leaving the RCA. Now, the question of who runs British racing has been simmering all year. At the weekend, the Racecourse Association published its governance review, and the Jockey Club's initial response was a single sentence of, I think it's fair to say, barely disguised contempt. It was followed today by the announcement they are quitting the RCA, stating that the proposals unveiled fail to address our fundamental concern that the RCA will stifle the necessary changes needed to our industry. This is a pretty seismic development. Mm-hmm. For those who have not been following the story closely, give us the potted summary of how we got to this remarkable moment.
Yeah, look, it's a conversation that I've heard so many times about the RCA and whether it's properly able to represent its racecourses. It runs a system, or had run a system before the reforms it's proposed, whereby each member had a vote. And that just simply wouldn't do if you're a jockey club, if you're one of those larger racecourses with a materially different business model to the smaller tracks. So with Lord Allen's departure came this sort of separate news story, no less significant, that Ascot, the large independents, Chester, were essentially calling on the RCA to reform, saying we need to be properly represented or we're going to leave this body. Now, Ascot jumped before those reforms appeared. Mm-hmm. The RCA's taken the time, conducted a reform and chose the Saturday of Goodwood, for reasons known only to them, to announce that, essentially proposing a system whereby large courses, smaller courses, they get a 25% share, almost pulled together, you get a 25% vote, as well as some operational reforms. Now, the operational reforms and that general commitment to go to a more representative model was welcomed by Goodwood, welcomed by Newbury, York. But the Jockey Club's statement on Saturday saying that it was tone deaf to announce this during Goodwood kind of hinted that we might be busy this morning. Mm. And so it has proved. So the Jockey Club and Ascot are essentially splintering away from the RCA. The question now is, what do they do? And indeed, what now for the RCA, which serves a very important operational function, I think. There's some very good people working there, but ultimately it can't or has not yet committed to the constitutional reforms that are sort of required, I think, to drive the sport forward.
Yeah, it was striking that during Goodwood's biggest week, which was the rationale under which the Jockey Club called the announcement tone deaf, Goodwood themselves were actually quite fine with it and they signed up to it. So the writing was certainly on the wall there. Jim Mullen, the chief executive of the Jockey Club, has put out a statement today. He's also spoken to the Racing Post. We'll have more from Jim later. There's some really interesting passages in this statement which I think are worth delving into, because they tell us both why this decision has been made but and also hint at what might come next. I think the most striking line was that Mullen said of the RCA proposals, which the Jockey Club has been so scathing of at the weekend, that nothing proposed would displace the RCA as the political representative of British racecourses. So that's That's actively saying that what the RCA have proposed around their representatives no longer being RCA representatives would not give them the level of independence that satisfied the Jockey Club. And Mullen added, our view, confirmed by recent discussions, that the RCA would continue to vote against necessary changes such as the introduction of an independent BHA board and substantive changes to the fixture list. So this really cuts to the core of it. Yeah. They're saying the RCA have put forward these proposals, but they're essentially window dressing. They do not deal with what we want to see happen, and they will not unlock the kind of more radical steps, as some would see it, that the Jockey Club and Ascot perhaps want to see. And I think that line about the fixture list, of course, is really interesting, because that is a dividing point down the middle of the sports race courses.
Absolutely. And it's this BHA independent board is the key thing here. The RCA, this is, I don't know about you, Tom, but I've had this conversation so many times for years. I'm almost surprised it's taken this long. It has an almost impossible job in a way. It's a bit like British racing structure generally. If you could set it alight, pour holy water and start again, you would. But I think we're too late for that, unfortunately. Yeah. But it's got a situation whereby it's trying to represent the interests of too many different race courses and business models. And as there has been an acknowledgement, albeit far slower than many other major sports, that it needs to be more commercial, it makes it harder and harder to properly put that case forward when you're representing different interests. Everyone, I think, acknowledges the need for a BHA independent board. There has to be some sort of division. And it just feels as though the RCA's ability to properly represent racecourses, or indeed whether it even, I don't think it even should actually at this point, that's where this is going to come down to. And it requires some sort of, as they put it, constitutional change, that the reforms that they've proposed don't go nearly far enough in addressing.
Well, the fascinating thing now, of course, is that the RCA is without some of the sport's most important race courses. Cheltenham, Ascot, Aintree, Epsom, all gone, with it taking a very significant chunk of the sport's prize money, its crowds, its group and grade one races, and of course its TV time as well. So this is not just about the number of tracks departing, it's about the influence they have. Mm-hmm. It really does look like the prospect of almost a breakaway, actually. To go back to the Mullen statement, it was very interesting because he talked about how they will be working with Ascot and other like-minded industry partners. I thought that was very striking. Not just racecourses, like-minded industry partners to pursue a vision based on the long-term sustainability of the sport. We are in the early stages of establishing a new organisation to do this. Just the language there is very interesting to me, because he doesn't say we are talking to other race courses, he says, like-minded industry partners, and he says a new organisation to do this. That organisation, what shape it takes, who it represents, what it tries to do, will be very interesting. Clearly, the Jockey Club want to work through the BHA, but this really does leave a lot of options open to them, doesn't it?
Yeah, it strikes me that that's the ideal scenario, is that Simon Cox comes in, you get an independent board, the Jockey Club works with it, it becomes more, the BHA and the race courses are able to, they're able to have their say, they're able to be more commercial and drive the sport forward. But there is enough wiggle room in that whereby if change continues to be stifled, if we don't see major, basically structural change for the entire sport, we're happy to go and do it ourselves with people who are willing to take those brave steps, who aren't benefiting from the status quo anymore and understand that you need to be more commercial, need to be more forward thinking. What it means for the RCA, I don't know. Possibly they revert to being essentially a trade body that offers organisational support, something like that. It does serve a function. I think that's acknowledged. But it always did strike me that I always felt as though the RCA had more power over decision making than it probably ought to have, really. Given it's essentially, you know, a representative body. It's a representative body that for a long time it has been felt does not proportionately represent those big courses that are contributing the most.
And that's really the challenge, because racing's always been divided between the practitioners, the horsemen, and the race courses. But what we've seen in recent years is a real fracturing of that race course group, as the big tracks, the ones that are focused on the quality of sport, have increasingly diverged from those parts of the sport which are more focused on quantity, which is ARC and the small independents, generally speaking.
I remember having a conversation with a who will remain unnamed racecourse executive who pitched this must be 4 or 5 years ago now, saying, I would love to see a two-tiered system whereby you almost have, all right, you wouldn't like to call it premier and non-premier, because we all know how premier racing went, but you can see the logic, right? Because the promoting the best product, the biggest tracks, experiences is one thing. You can't use a blunt object and then deal with betting turnover, sort of media rights driving, that sort of side of it as well. You could see a different regulation, different promotion, different commercial priorities, just split it entirely in two and do it that way. But again, it's so much untangling is required. I'm still not entirely on top of all of the acronyms and everything, even after 8 years.
Even as Mr. Governance.
Even as Mr. Governance.
Even as Mr. Governance.
I have the wall chart at home. But it's so hard, because it's hard to... And I do have sympathy for the RCA in a way, because it was almost an impossible brief. How can you possibly properly represent essentially just completely different businesses all at once?
Yeah, exactly. It goes to the core of the challenges of running such a diverse sport as British racing.
Yeah.
I'm interested, Liam, in the reaction. Perhaps it's too early for the reaction from trainers in Lambourne, but anything you're picking up from the professionals there, and more generally, what the trainers, jockeys, stable staff of Lambourne want to see from the BHA, from the BHA's new chair, Simon Cox, and from the racecourses?
Well, I think you kind of look at what's happened today, and you kind of left questioning almost what power does the RCA have now? As we've mentioned, it's lost Ascot a while back, and now the Jockey Club, who are responsible for so many big tracks around the country. It's a huge organisation. You know, you take them out of the equation now and you just think, well, what strength hold do the RCA have going forward? So, listen, Simon Cox has got an awfully sort of a huge job ahead of him when he starts in October. I mean, this is something that needs to be addressed. I mean, it's something that should have been addressed years ago. We seem to be on the same old merry-go-round yet again with British racing. But I just think this needs to be... one of probably the only thing he needs to sort out as soon as he steps into that role in a few weeks' time, because the sense of direction of the sport is questionable. We don't know almost who's got the overriding control of where the sport's going and what this will do to the sport in the next 2 to 3 years.
Yeah, some big questions ahead for the RCA, for the BHA and their new chair, Simon Cox, but also for everyone who loves the sport and is worried about its direction of travel. We'll have everything on this story today and as it unfolds over the coming weeks. So do stay tuned to racingpost.com. But let's move on, because on the track, we had so much to celebrate. It really was one of those weeks, John, where the on-course action was at its peak. Goodwood was at its brilliant, sunny best. Galway, raucous and unpredictable as ever. We had some fantastic performances from our equine stars, some young jockeys really cementing their claim to being among the most exciting sportsmen in the world. Where do we start? Shall we begin with Bo Echo, who did what no horse since Frankel has done in completing the 2000 Guineas, St. James's Palace and Sussex Stakes treble. And overcame a fairly troubled passage to do it as well. Billy Loughnan in the saddle looked in total command.
Yeah,
it was
did.
Exhilarating to watch, wasn't it?
It was just brilliant, yeah. As Mr. Governance, I spent a lot of my time sort of getting stuck into infighting and debates and structural change and the small print. But to be at Goodwood, I stood in the betting ring actually kind of trying to test the temperature there. And the noise when he went past and crossed the line it took me by surprise, really. It felt like I was at Cheltenham, which you associate with that loud roar. It was genuinely, it helped that four favourites had won before him, and then he was probably the best backed of all of them. But yeah, it's just one of those stories, and it has all of those universal things. You're a rising star, unbeaten, untapped potential, that comparison to greats that we love. A lot of unnamed people on Twitter dislike us comparing horses to Frankel, but I just think, why not? Cheer up. It's just, why wouldn't you? He's great. He's the most exciting horse in training. by a long way. Mm. Billy Lochnan is the most exciting jockey we've got, I think, now in terms of potential. And why not celebrate it and make the most of it? I thought it was brilliant. I thought it was just a brilliant week, if not a shade too hot.
Shade too hot. Okay, yeah. It's always something. It can't be perfect, though, can it? I mean, let's turn to that Frankel comparison, because it is kind of legitimate. Unavoidable. Frankel is the yardstick by which all subsequent greats are measured. And on pure ratings, Bo Echo is clearly a level below, which you would expect Bo Echo to be. But how good is the horse? Is there another level we haven't seen yet?
I hope so. Yeah, he's very good. And what I love is George Bowie. Every time I've spoken to him, I spoke to him before the season started for a stable tour and before pretty much every run. And he's ice cool, just says, yeah, he's unbelievable. He's a pleasure. He's getting better and better. So, look, to win like that from that position against two seriously good horses, we don't know how good he is yet. You can see him going to another level. Is that likely to be a Frankel level? Probably not, because he's not running against the same level of opposition. But why can't we get excited about the prospect of that, surely?
Absolutely.
This is the hill I'm going to die on today. Well, we should be able to compare horses to the past greats, just like you compare footballers to old footballers. It's a different game, different opposition. That's fine, but we have the data. We're not saying he's as good as Frankel, but we're allowed to get excited about the fact that he could be. Who knows? Mm. Who knows how good he's going to be?
Well, I agree with you. Liam, where do you stand on this question? Frankel comparison, sacrilege or legitimate sporting debate?
Of course it's a sporting debate. I mean, like Jonathan said, we're allowed to... You see a young footballer coming through, all of a sudden, oh, he's the next Messi, he's the next Ronaldo. You see a young Formula One driver coming through, he's the next Schumacher, Hamilton. Every other sport you're allowed to compare. It's what is great about sport. You're allowed to do it. Everyone's entitled to their own opinion. Yeah, as soon as you start comparing one unbeaten horse to another unbeaten horse, people on social media just kick up a fuss and say you shouldn't be doing that. Yes, or we've said it, the ratings don't strike up to what Frankel did in his career. But it was interesting to read Chris Cook's front runner piece this morning. He was saying that he thinks that Bo Echo's more fun to watch than Frankel. I mean, you have to look at some of the races that Frankel won. He was going off 1-10, 1-20 on to win these races. When Bo Echo won the 2000 Guineas, it was a 9-2 price. And I think the most exciting point from Bo Echo's point of view is the fact that he didn't have it his own way at Ascot. It was a very messy race in St James's Palace, and he won that. You know, people might say he was fortunate to win that race. But again, even the other day at Goodwood, he was completely trapped in. And at one point you thought, oh God, this is it. He's going to get beat. But the way he came through, the way that Billy operated him to find that gap and come through, just shows that no matter where he is in the field, the levels of performance, he's still got that quality to overturn any outcome and still come out on top. So I still do think the best is yet to come. With Frankel, we've obviously seen in a lot of his races, he goes and went to the front and just kicked on and went away, whereas Bo Echo's kind of had to deal with a few sort of challenges on the way. So I do think we're going to see a lot more, and it'll be interesting now if the Bowie team target him towards France, which is what they're talking about. Frankel never went to France, so again, this is another opportunity to kind of cement those credentials.
Yeah, some exciting targets ahead. The Jacques Lemarois and Prix du Moulin have been mentioned over in France, as you said, but also potentially a trip to Keeneland for the Breeders' Cup. As you say, things that Frankel never tried doesn't mean that doing them would propel him to those lofty heights, but it's the prospect of seeing Bo Echo really being challenged. And as you say, he's not going to go off 1-20 in these races. He's going to get a serious challenge, as travelling for any horse is a significant leap into the unknown.
Yeah, 100%. I think it's just exciting. I mean, again, he's a public horse. I don't think we've had that kind of public horse on the flat since Frankel. Bo Echo, I think, like you said, Tom, I mean, these unbeaten horses, you know, they draw the public in. And, you know, we've seen it on the jumps with some of these stars. You know, they win big races, and especially when the favourites, it obviously pleases punters if they've had a bit of money on him as well. So I just think he's a public horse, and as Jonathan alluded to, I mean, the way that George Bowie's been so cool, calm and collected over the whole thing, I mean, the fact that he, Boeco, went straight to the Guineas without a prep run, and there was question marks over whether that was the right thing to do, and clearly it was. I mean, he's obviously been lighting up work at home in Newmarket, so I just think let the comparisons continue. We've got a superstar on our hands, and just almost enjoy the ride.
Well, Liam, fans of Bide going to be screaming, filling up the comments at your comment that Boeco is the first public horse since Frankel. But let's move to Billy Loughnan, who has had an incredible few years establishing himself very rapidly as one of the most exciting young jockeys in the world. I think at Goodwood, there's a very strong claim that he has sort of cemented his claim to be the best young rider in the world.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, everyone I've spoke to in recent weeks, and certainly at Goodwood last week, just, I mean, they're amazed at how impressive Billy is. I mean, he's still 20 years old, and I mean, the stuff that he's doing now, you can only imagine if he continues on this trajectory, who knows where he'll be in 3, 4, 5 years' time. The situations he's getting out of during races, he's just so level-headed, and I just think we're going to see him dominate the sport for the years to come, the way that he's doing things.
And you did a piece yesterday, I think, looking at the Jockeys' Championship. He has a real shot at getting his first, doesn't he?
He does, and I think, listen, he's got a great agent behind him in Tony Hind, and I think he's going to be gunning for that title. You know, he's made such an impressive, you know, he's just had an impressive season so far. You know, he's winning the big races, and obviously it comes down to numbers of winners rather than sort of the calibre of races you're winning. But he's really going to be gunning for that first title. O'Sheen Murphy in second, I mean, didn't have the best of Glorious Goodwoods by his standards. He only had the one winner, but he fired in a four-timer at Chester yesterday to kind of sort of almost say, I'm still here, I'm still fighting. Listen, O'Sheen's a five-time champion himself, so he knows what it takes to win the races. But I think what Billy has in his favour is the fact that his commitments between now and the end of the flat season, when the title's wrapped up on Champions Day, is he's going to be in Britain a lot more than O'Sheen. O'Sheen's got a lot of commitments, you know, in France, in Ireland, across Europe, where he's going to be needed to ride for other owners. So it's an opportunity for Billy to sort of take advantage of that and try and get that first title, as you say.
What about Dylan Brown McMonagall, best young rider in Europe? We were very definitive then. There was Billy.
Yeah. Where would your money be?
I was worried there'd be a follow-up question. I'm just saying there's not, to my eye, there's not an awful lot to split them. Both hugely exciting. That's me sitting on the fence.
Yeah.
But shout out Dylan Brown McMonagall.
Absolutely fair. What a brilliant time for young jockeys, actually. Let's talk about a few other equine stars from Goodwood as well, though, because Diamond Necklace deserves her share of the time. She's sort of living in Boeco's shadow this season, but she's pretty impressive and could have a very exciting back end of the season.
She could. The Nassau Stakes bugs me a bit. It's always slightly field-wise a little bit disappointing, but looking at it, that was still a high-quality field. If Group 1 winner in Friendly Soul ran very well, See the Fire, it's not gone completely to plan, but still a very good yardstick, and she's beaten them incredibly comfortably. So I think she's top of the pile, really, in terms of three-year-old fillies, and certainly three-year-old fillies at Ballydoyle, which is usually the same thing. I don't think she's top of the three-year-olds there, which is Constitution River's still the man, I think, which slightly worries me, because I'd love to see her run in an arc, via an arc trial, like try the arc trial, see if she gets it, and then go as part of that Longchamp team with Constitution River. But it might be she goes somewhere else. But as Aidan O'Brien said afterwards, I mean, he listed every possible country and race, and that is just testament to how good she is. She's the best we've seen, I think, this season.
Yeah.
Will end strong, I'm sure. But for me, I'd love to see her in an arc, like a lot of people, but they might stick to a mile and a quarter because they're fairly well covered in the arc as it is.
An abundance of riches. Another gem in the Coolmore tiara was I don't know where I was going to go with that. Scandinavia absolutely demolished Trollerman.
Funny race, though.
Funny race, yeah.
Yeah, odd, with Amelot getting involved and cutting right across. I don't think it made any difference.
Mm.
Oh, well, I say that. It made a difference. It checked Trawlerman a little bit. I think it sort of slightly impeded both of them.
It ended his challenge at the moment where it looked like his challenge was going to get ended by the horse.
Yeah, exactly right. I think Scandinavia is the best there. We've seen that twice. Trawlerman, a very close second. They're by far, I think, the top two. And Scandinavia, yeah, we start with comparisons to former Ballydoyle stayers at this point, but he's all class. And for Ryan Moore to come off and sort of compare him to the likes of Yates and horses like that is just, you don't need me to tell you how good he is.
Two other stories I think worth mentioning from Goodwood. Kaya Fraser, 23-year-old from Hackney, who won his first group race. And at the other end of the sort of power spectrum is Wathnan Racing, who had a mighty week at Goodwood, topping the owner charts, seeing off Coolmore.
Seven winners, was it?
I think so, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, extraordinary. I spoke to Richard Brown of Wathnan Racing a few times during the week, and he goes into these weeks thinking, almost talking himself out of having any winner, which is foolish, really, given where they ended up. Seven is a remarkable return. It's been written countless times. It's a meeting that is more important to them, given the Visit Qatar involvement, given the Qatari link there. Mm. Royal Ascot still, I think, is number one priority, but having winners at Goodwood is very important. And, yeah, they did seven times. So I don't know what they were worried about.
No,
really.
Indeed. But, you know, Wathnan are spending some really significant sums in sport, but it is not a guarantee of success. Plenty of big ownership operations have shown that. They have done some seriously shrewd business.
They have, yeah. They just, it strikes me as an organisation that's going about it the right way from the outside. I don't know the inner workings. They sort of came in and was throwing quite big sums around for horses in training. You sort of think, it's trying to see the logic to it, but it has worked really, you know, really well. And yeah, that was just that was almost the accumulation of that last week. I guess, where do they go from here? Keep investing, keep reinvesting. And yeah, it was interesting to see that, you know, there it was spread across a few trainers as well, which is a good thing. You know, there's, people are reaping the benefits of Wathnan Racing pumping this money in.
Certainly. Let's turn very quickly, Liam, to Galway. The big story coming out of the marathon in the west of Ireland was Dan King's double in the Galway Plate and Galway Hurdle. 21-year-old doing something no jockey has done since 1984 and announcing himself as one of the most exciting young riding talents on the jumps. Liam, what did you make of it?
Yeah, it was, you know, it's always a challenge trying to keep a close eye on both Goodwood and Galway, seeing as they happen at the same time. But this was probably the story of the week, I think, with Daniel King, you know, winning the Plate and the Hurdle. Like you said, first time anyone's done that in a long time, and at a young age again. You know, we talk about Billy Lotnan and all these other young heads, but Daniel King, certainly a name to throw into the hat of riders to follow. I mean, these are big fields, these are competitive races, and let alone winning one of them at a young age is impressive. But to do the double up was something I'm sure he'll remember for many years to come.
Are we allowed to compare him to Ruby Walsh?
I think it's been done.
Yeah.
I can't remember who it was, but someone,
claim,
was it Martin?
Yeah, Tony Martin.
Compared, a young Ruby Walsh.
Yeah, how about that?
Yeah, comparisons.
Yeah, they're allowed. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I can see it. He's all class, isn't he?
Yeah.
Super calm. There does seem to be this younger generation of sports people who are just better prepared probably than their predecessors.
Mm.
Very media savvy,
Gen
very
Z.
Calm, very balanced.
Oh, with chaotic millennials.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on to our third story, which is the news that Betfred are going to be shutting over 130 shops, losing 600 jobs and costing horse racing about £4 million in lost earnings. But the real story here is what's been happening over the last few years, because Betfred's closures are the latest in what has been a steady flow of betting shop shutterings. We've had 500 in the last year. That's before Betfred's 130 are added to them. And you're looking at around £20 million in annual lost income from that. And since June 2020, more than 1,800 betting shops have closed across Britain and Ireland, which is an absolutely enormous blow to the sports media rights model. Every single shop, or certainly every Betfred shop, contributes in the region of £30,000 a year in levy and media rights. Fred Doan of Betfred blamed tax increases and regulation for the closures, and said that the Betfred estate had gone from 1,650 shops to just under 1,100 in 6 years. Do we think this is the end? And if not, what is the fate for the betting shop estate and thus for horse racing?
You always throw to me for the bad news. I think this is the direction of travel, as much as I hate to say it. You know, there's a world in which betting shops, I think, were quite an important part sometimes of their community, as somewhere people would go, engage with sport. It just feels as though those days are perhaps gone. Is there a world in which there are no betting shops? Possibly, I hope not. But it's definitely only going in one direction, isn't it? And to absolutely nobody's surprise, I should add, you know, we had, with the taxation changes, racing celebrated what I said at the time was a fairly hollow victory because bookmakers were still getting hit. And you might have won here, but you are really going to feel the effects. And lo and behold, here we are. And bookmakers are good to their word. If we are overregulated, if there's regulatory uncertainty, if we are taxed too much, and if it makes sense to do our business elsewhere in different sports and different mediums without the land-based betting so much, then we're going to do that because that's how businesses work. And so it proved. And yeah, they're having to tighten their belts. And as such, through that symbiotic relationship, racing will only suffer. And I'm afraid to say, I this won't be the last one, I don't think, with consolidation of that land-based.
Well, betting shops have been closing for a long time as people move from the high street to online. But I think that what's really interesting is the external forces which are now accelerating that.
Exactly. Yeah.
Clearly, taxation and regulation is a big part of it, even though betting shops were spared direct increases. But the concern is that they might not be spared direct tax increases in future. The Social Market Foundation, the think tank which was behind some of the proposals which informed the government's taxation changes last year, have now proposed doubling machine games duty from 20% to 40%. That's the tax betting shops play on the machines in their shops. This really should come as a surprise to absolutely no one that the SMF is continuing to ratchet up its demands for increases to gambling taxation. Regulus, a betting analysis consultancy, suggests that that could result, a 20% to 40% shift, in 4,000 of Britain's 5,500 betting shops closing, costing around 25,000 jobs and 100 million in media rights and levy income for British horse racing. If the SMF proposal gains traction under the new PM, Andy Burnham, how should British racing respond?
In the strongest terms, I think there's this really interesting situation happening whereby gambling has, to my mind anyway, I'm just speaking for myself, has become almost being treated as a public health issue and has long been kind of low-hanging fruit, I think, for politicians. It's very easy to tax bookmakers and take them, you know, put them under pressure because it's a free win, really. It's sort of, they're very easy industry to beat with a stick, but there's also the Treasury demands. They're also a very lucrative industry that provides a lot through the to the Exchequer. So I just see that's how it's going to play out for me. You know, you've got the SMF who'd be very much on the public health and challenging gambling and wanting to regulate it more and more and more. And then you've probably got some people in the Treasury saying, hang on a minute, let's... And I think that's where we end up, somewhere in the middle. But even the middle is fairly disastrous for racing, if bookmakers just go, well, we've had enough. There's so many other territories, so many other lucrative things we can be doing. Yeah. This is no longer one of them. For all we like the prestige of Britain and racing and being involved in that, if the numbers don't add up, they don't add up. So for racing, I think they have to work more closely with bookmakers than they did before. I understand the AXA racing tax. I understand wanting to take their future into their own hands, but possibly should have worked well. To my mind, definitely should have worked more closely with bookmakers.
Well, absolutely. Some in British racing did the opposite, and they worked with the SMF.
Shouldn't have done that.
Outriders. Like, yeah, But, you know, under this entirely mistaken belief that if you persuade the tiger to eat someone else, it's not going to eat you later.
Well, that was exactly right, yeah. You know, bookmakers and racing ultimately want the same thing. They want racing to thrive, and they want the bookmaking industry to be providing what it does to the treasury within the confines of, you know, operating in a sensible, responsible way. I think that's what's going to have to happen. I think with the BHA chair, Simon Coates will get together and build a few more bridges with the bookmaking industry and present more of a united front. Because it was never going to stop at affordability checks, and it was never going to stop at taxation. It will keep going and going. For some people, it will never be enough.
Yeah. Liam, Fred Doane, who is the Betfred founder, you know, spoke quite emotionally about shutting the shops. But of course, Fred's not just a major bookmaker. He's also the man who sponsors all of the British flat classics. It really does speak to just how bound up the sport and traditional betting operators are.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, racing relies so much on the betting industry. And like you said, you know, Betfred, they sponsor the biggest races of the season. And you only had to see the statement that Fred said on Betfred TV the other day. He said it was like, I think, killing babies. He said something
like that.
That's
what he said, yeah. No, he said exactly right.
Like it's a decision that he's probably had to think long and hard about, it because he's been responsible for building Betfred up to what it is today. And I think this kind of sets a precedent about what is going to happen sort of over the next few years, you know, with other bookmakers and things. And as we've mentioned, I don't think it's going to be the last time we're going to be talking about a betting firm having to shut a number of shops because of costs and the economic structure going forward. So it really is a worrying time for racing, because as I said at the top of this chat, you know, the racing needs this the betting sort of turnover and the money that comes from it to kind of continue supporting the sport.
Okay, let's finish up with Jim Crowley, who announced his retirement at Goodwood at the weekend, John. He's 48, was trying to come back from a terrible fall at York last September, but he's now decided that his riding career is over and he's going to apply for a training licence. What a remarkable career Jim had, because he obviously started as a jump jockey. He's one of a very small number of jockeys who have transitioned, but he was as talented as he was as a jump jockey, and it's a pretty accomplished one, he has had a fantastic second career, became champion jockey in 2016, and was appointed retained rider at Shadwell, for whom he has done a tremendous job, including riding some truly tremendous horses, including Batash and Baid. He got a great reception from his jockeys at Goodwood. What does that tell you about the man?
It tells me nothing I don't already know from my dealings with him. You know, I kind of rank jockeys by how much I enjoy talking to them, and he's right up there because he is genuinely very nice for those listening and watching.
He's a lovely fella.
And also, he's so nice you forget he's also an elite sportsman as well. He's been at the top of his game for a long time. Mm. So reliable in big races, so experienced. The reception at Goodwood tells you everything. Also so liked in the weighing room. And yeah, I've got very fond memories of some of those associations. Batash, Baid, I think he was brilliant, probably the best horse he rode, I'd say. Ulysses was another one he used to ride. He's just ice cool, very measured, very calm, very good with the press, most importantly. And these are all things, I think, that are going to bode very well for his next career. I genuinely would be watching with interest how he gets on as a trainer. I really hope it's a success, because he's given so much to the sport, had a fantastic career. I'm sad he didn't get to come back as he would have liked and go out on his own terms. Mm. But at the same time, he's had a career that almost every jockey would give their right arm for. So,
and I love the fact that his best moment in his career came beyond the age that most sports people are retiring. So he was in his late 30s and into his 40s when success really began to accrue to him, when he got the Shadwell job and when those great horses came along. I mean, what an amazing trajectory. I mean, it gives us all hope as well.
Exactly right, yeah. For the late bloomers amongst us, that's fantastic. No, it's just, I don't know what to say. I just don't begrudge him anything. He's just a lovely guy, fantastic career, and yeah, I'm sure he'll make a real success of the next stage.
Yeah. Liam, what's the ride or horse that stands out for you as emblematic of Jim's career?
For me, I think Batash. I just think with what, I mean, I've probably got my Lambon head on now with Charlie Hills, but I just think he was the sort of horse that, you know, turned up on the biggest occasions so many times. Similar to Baid as well. I mean, just the plethora of horses and that Shadwell had, you know, Jim was the sort of driving force, you know, in the hot seat. And I just think that, like you said, his ability to get better the older he got as well. I mean, getting the Shadwell job was huge, but being able to keep it as well, you know, he didn't just keep that job because he was a genuine person and easy to get on with. He kept it because he was riding at the top of his game. You know, you see jockeys and ownerships changing jockeys every so often. And Shadwell stuck with him because they could see his talents from a mile off, and he was able to do it justice by winning so many big races.
Yeah, it's tremendous stuff. And now, as John says, he's going to go into training. What do you make of his chances? It's a hard transition to make, as other jockeys have found in the past, but Jim brings with it a wealth of experience, but also, you know, a really sort of intuitive intelligence for the game.
Yeah, listen, it's so hard. I mean, I've never done it myself, but it's so hard for any young trainer to sort of step into the trainer ranks for the first time. And, you know, it comes with its challenges, as we well know. But I think with Jim, you know, he's been round horses probably since he can never remember. And he's had experiences dealing with, you know, these ownerships, these trainers, and that will put him in good stead. You know, I think having the knowledge of dealing with horses day in, day out is one thing, but having that reputation of being a stand-up person will also put you in good stead to continue those connections and also create new ones as well. So I'm fairly certain that he'll have a good success when he does take that next step in his career.
Absolutely. Well, best of luck to Jim. What a fantastic career. And I hope he goes on to have similar success in the training ranks. That's all we've got time for this week. Thank you very much, John. Thank you very much, Liam. Last week was absolutely scintillating on the track, but as today's news with the Jockey Club dropping out of the RCA shows, the fun never stops in horse racing. Stick with us on the Racing Post for all the news, and we will be back, of course, same time, same place next week on the front page to discuss it all. Until then, goodbye.